It is Monday, August the 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, tough times for Turkey's economy.
If its stock market and other foreign exchange markets tend to tumble, then they won't be able to do it. So it will end up compounding itself.
White supremacists and counter-protesters rally near the White House.
I'm sure I'm not the only person who was just like, what? On the anniversary of when you killed someone, you're going to come to D.C. and say you're uniting your forces?
Also ahead, heightened concerns about safety after a man steals and crashes a commercial plane, plus the world of music. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Turkey's finance minister says his government has prepared an action plan aimed at easing market concerns that have led to a slump in the value of the nation's currency, the lira. Turkey was hit by a financial shockwave this past week as the lira nosedived 14% over concerns about the government's economic policies and a trade and diplomatic dispute with the United States. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal tells VOA's Victor Beatty, Turkey has been having economic problems for months.
In the case of Turkey, things had started to go wrong in the very early stages of 2018. The economy is heavily dependent on foreign capital. And that foreign capital has to be repaid. The current account deficit is quite large. And with the pressure on the lira, there has been a tendency to walk away from lira, which complicates matters in the sense that now Turkey will have even less resources available to repay. So there is it's a big uncertainty that has been created all around. Now, part of the problem has been compounded by policy that was implemented by the United States, doubling the tariffs on steel imports from Turkey and aluminum imports, which, you know, has its own implications, and you can understand that it adds to uncertainty and to instability. The reaction of the government has been pretty swift, and they've politicized it. In the process of politicizing it, actually they've made it good as well as bad at the same time. Good in the sense that it has been able to get a popular support, and bad in the sense that now whatever policies are implementing are likely to make things complicated. So the new model, economic model that they are trying to pursue is a very odd one, but it's a political response to an economic problem. And that's a dangerous thing to do.
Well, as you know, a Turkish delegation came to Washington to discuss some of the issues between Turkey and the U.S., but apparently went away with no progress.
That's right. And that's the dangerous part of it all. You see, remember, the problem actually is not new. This has been going on since the abortive coup. Whether one likes it or not, the Turks continue to blame the American interest in that coup. And whether it is right or wrong, we have no position to say anything about this. But then what it causes is that it tends to compound the political problem by worsening the economic issue.
In an opinion piece in the New York Times on Friday, President Erdogan criticized tensions with the U.S., saying, quote, a failure to reverse this trend of unilateralism and disrespect will require us to start looking for new friends and allies. Is this an opportunity for Russia, perhaps China, and what of the future of NATO?
Well, NATO itself is in a very iffy state, has been for the last 2 years now. The point is, the Turks are going to be looking for their exports, markets for their exports. If the global economy slows down, those markets are not going to emerge. And Russia is certainly not in a position to compensate. It's the European Union that will have to compensate. And if the European Union is hurt, and if its stock market and other foreign exchange markets tend to tumble, then they won't be able to do it. So it will end up compounding itself. So what I'm trying to emphasize is stop the silliness now rather than allow it to become a major global crisis.
Prior to joining the Middle East Institute as adjunct scholar in 2008, Zubair Iqbal worked with the International Monetary Fund for 35 years, retiring in 2007 as its assistant director of the Middle East and Central Asia Department. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Two separate and distinct groups of protesters, white supremacists and their opponents, descended on Washington, D.C. on Sunday. The protests came 1 year after the white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, which isn't very far from Washington, that exploded into violence. A young female counter-demonstrator that day was run over and killed in that protest by a car driven by a self-confessed white supremacist. Sunday's gathering was led by the principal organizer of last year's Unite the Right event, Jason Kessler.
Regardless of whether people think I'm a jerk or I'm a racist or whatever, just understand that that I have rights.
International Edition's Lori London talked to VOA correspondent Arash Arabasadi, who attended the dueling rallies, noting the white supremacists appear to be vastly outnumbered by the counter-protesters, the police, and journalists as they walk down the Washington streets to a park across the street from the White House.
They were outnumbered really even before the day started, with estimates of at least 10 to 1. And being there, the crowd was so thick that we really had a hard time even seeing where they were. So if not for the partitions and if not for the rows of police, I'm a pretty tall guy. I couldn't see anything. I would not have known that they were even there.
How many counter-protesters were you say were there? Was it in the hundreds? Could it be in the thousands?
It was easily in the hundreds. Could have possibly been in the thousands. I mean, the entire Lafayette Park area up until 8th Street was just packed, and the rain didn't stop anybody from coming out.
Did you have a chance to hear anything that the white nationalists had to say or what their message was and see anything that they were doing in this event?
There were a couple people who walked through the crowd challenging the counter-protesters and basically saying that these are their First Amendment rights. And however, when anybody went to interview them with a microphone, they were being shouted down by people around them saying hate speech is not your constitutional right. I mean, the crowd was lively, and for whatever it's worth, it took some guts for those people, for the few white nationalist folks to have walked into what is a hostile crowd. This is not Charlottesville. This is Washington, D.C. It's a pretty diverse place, and it was clear by the locals that this was not a welcome.
Did they say in advance what the purpose of this rally was for them, what they hoped to achieve, what their message was?
One of the things the organizers made clear on their website was that they were trying to distance themselves from the activity that took place last year in Charlottesville. Folks there, they said, were giving the white nationalist movement a bad name. And they were even really going so far as to say, you've made us all look like a bunch of crazy people. You've made us all look like we're out of our minds, and you've embarrassed us on the international stage. The goal was initially for them to move white nationalism more into the mainstream and to be something that is more accepted. And they felt that everything that happened last year totally derailed any chance they had at being a legitimate, viable political and socioeconomic movement. So what they did this year, and what they were clear on their website, they said, you're welcome to bring your flags so long as they meet national park regulations of size. Please bring only your American flags or your Confederate flags, leaving at home other flags such as Nazi flags that people were waving last year in Charlottesville. So this particular Unite the Right rally, Unite the Right 2, the idea was to shine the light on their message.
And is their message white superiority, that they don't want people of color or other ethnicities to be in the U.S.? Does that go?
I wish that I had the ability to actually reach those folks and speak with them directly, but their official message on their webpage is to make sure that white people are not forgotten, that there's been so many advances made for women, for people of color, for people who are homosexual.
Minorities.
And minorities mm-hmm. in general. And so there's this feeling, and these are their words, not mine, but there's this feeling that they're being left behind in a country that is evolving around them and without them. But others would say, well, the country's evolving and you're refusing to accept that there is change. Change is inevitable, and you can fight it all you want. It's going to happen, and that maybe you're going to be on the wrong side of history. But the official word that they put out is that they just want white heritage to not be erased from American culture.
What about the counter-protesters? It sounds like you were just inundated with that crowd, and I'm sure they had a lot to say why they came out in such force.
They did, and it was a variety of people who were carrying signs of anti-fascism, anti-Nazi, anti-the-president, Black Lives Matter. It was a really diverse crowd. Really, I've lived in D.C. now for 10 years, and it's just about what I would have expected to see in D.C. streets. People of all ethnicities and sexual identification really just kind of coming together as this is our city and we are a diverse city, and what you stand for is not something that's welcome here. As outnumbered as they were and as much as they were trying to make a message in front of the White House, which in and of itself is a big deal, it started to rain and they said, okay, we'll pack it up, we're going home. I mean, to me, it's kind of like, wow, you folks came from not here. You gathered from other places in the country. You came all the way to D.C. and you dealt with everything you had to deal with in terms of being in really hostile territory for a group some people would see as being hateful and as being ultra exclusive to minorities. And it starts to rain and you pack up and go home. I kind of saw it as like, wow, you really didn't even stick around with your own message.
Right. The counter-protesters, I guess, didn't want to leave and they did stick around.
Counter-protesters were, we had to kind of push our way through the counter-protesters to get back the Voice of America so that we could produce our TV story. The counter-protesters seemed like they're perfectly happy hanging out with one another and having, having their own moment of unity while there was supposedly a Unite the Right rally that went looking for cover when the skies started to open up.
That is VOA correspondent Arash Arabasadi speaking with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. The theft of an empty plane by an airline worker in the U.S. state of Washington illustrated what aviation experts have long known, that one of the biggest potential perils for commercial air travel is airline or airport employees causing some sort of mayhem. Video showed the Horizon Air turboprop that seats about 76 people doing large loops and other dangerous maneuvers before crashing into a small island. The Horizon Air employee who stole the plane was 29-year-old Richard Russell, who went by the nickname Bebo. He is presumed to have died in that crash. A Russell family spokesman, Mike Matthews, said they are stunned and heartbroken.
It may seem difficult for those watching at home to believe, but Bebo was a warm, compassionate man. It is impossible to encompass who he was in a press release. He was a faithful husband, a loving son, and a good friend.
John Cox is a retired pilot who is now CEO of Safety Operating Systems Aviation Consulting. He told VOA the incident surprised him for a number of reasons.
That an airline employee that is as thoroughly checked as airline employees are, vetted, background checked, trained, would do such a thing. That surprised me immensely. And secondly, it surprised me that he got it started. Turbine engine aircraft, unlike your car, require a specific set of switch movements and lever movements in a sequence to get the engines actually started. Not only that, then he got the propellers in the proper place. And so there's a lot of knowledge that he had to have gained to be able just to get the airplane started and moving.
And as for whether this is a sign of a bigger security lapse, Cox had this to say.
I think we have to wait until the investigation is complete to see, were there any breaches in security, were there any weaknesses identified, before we can determine if there is an unacceptable threat level or if this is just a one-off. I've been flying airplanes for 48 years and been an aircraft accident investigator for well over 30, and I'm only aware of one other case similar to this in those almost 50 years.
John Cox is a retired pilot who is now CEO of Safety Operating Systems Aviation Consulting. Some 400 years ago, English explorer Captain John Smith traveled around the Chesapeake Bay here in the eastern United States, the country's largest estuary, by the way. Smith mapped about 4,800 kilometers of the bay and nearby rivers. Now, 11 of those rivers can be seen in an entirely new way through a unique virtual online tour. VOA's Deborah Block got on board a small raft in the Patuxent River, loaded with camera and computer equipment, to find out how it's done.
Here on the Patuxent River in Maryland, a tributary of the Chesapeake Bay, this one-of-a-kind raft was designed and built by Ryan Abrahamson, founder of Terrain 360, a virtual mapping company. Inspired by Google Street View, Abrahamson has created 360-degree virtual mapping tours of rivers with a view of being in a canoe. Producing a virtual river map is a challenge.
On the center column we have at the top, we have the 6 cameras. The very top, we have a light sensor and a GPS unit. And down here at the bottom, we have a PC with an ultra-bright screen, touchscreen. The cameras are triggered by the computer. We record at the same time GPS coordinates. We record barometric pressure, humidity, temperature.
As the raft motors along the Patuxent, the extreme wide-angle lens cameras shoot photos simultaneously every 12 meters. It takes hundreds of thousands of the high-resolution images to create the virtual panoramic waterway tour. Today, Abrahamson is adding to the Patuxent River map with the addition of 20,000 new photos taken from a cove, with all kinds of things getting captured along the way. The virtual tours of 11 of the Chesapeake Bay rivers is funded by the Chesapeake Conservancy, an environmental group, and can be viewed on their website, ChesapeakeConservancy.org.
What we wanted to do was to give people the information and inspiration they needed to get outside, get on our rivers, explore the Chesapeake Bay so that they'll protect the Chesapeake Bay.
Abrahamson says while the virtual tours show the beauty of the rivers, they also reveal environmental problems.
Shoreline erosion, we look for pollution, storm drains, we see a lot of tires in the waterways, and just by showcasing that, it gives, the general public things need to be cleaned up. We want to care more about, where we live and our environment and the waterways.
Rivers like the Patuxent and others that flow into the Chesapeake Bay are near major cities such as Washington and Baltimore, giving more people the opportunity to enjoy the Chesapeake Bay watershed.
People can use the virtual tours to plan their trips from their desk at home or at work, but they can also use them out on the water on their smartphone from wherever they are.
Today, the rivers are part of the Captain John Smith Chesapeake National Historic Trail, the first all-water historic trail in the United States. Deborah Block, VOA News, on the Patuxent River in Maryland.
And still ahead, the sounds of Van McCoy in the Soul City Symphony. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
In the early 2000s, scientists uncovered an odd-looking, tiny lizard-like fossil in the Dolomites Mountains of northern Italy. An international team of paleontologists then set out to learn about the fossil's identity and origins. A new study published in the journal Nature reveals their findings. It turns out that the 76-millimeter-long fossil dates back 240 to 250 million years and has been identified as an ancient lizard species called Megachirella. The researchers say what they encountered is the oldest lizard fossil ever found. The study also reveals that the Megachirella is 75,000 years older than what were previously thought to be the oldest fossil lizards, leading some in the science community to call this ancient species the mother of all lizards and snakes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It is time now for a little something from the world of music.
Change with the time.
Van McCoy was an American musician, record producer, arranger, songwriter, singer, and orchestra conductor. He had more than 700 song copyrights to his credit and was noted for producing tunes for recording artists such as Gladys Knight and the Pips, the Stylistics, and Aretha Franklin, plus many more. Change with the Times was a big hit for McCoy and the Soul City Symphony, peaking on the Billboard Hot 100 chart in 1975. Van McCoy was born in Washington, D.C., where he learned to play the piano at a very young age and sang with the Metropolitan Church Choir as a youngster. By the age of 12, he had begun writing his own songs, in addition to performing in local amateur shows alongside his older brother. They formed a doo-wop combo named the Starlighters with two friends while they were still in high school. And in 1975, McCoy released To Low Expectations, the mostly instrumental LP, Disco Baby, and fans went wild over all the tracks, including Spanish Boogie.
Spanish Boogie.
Oh, sí, mama. A bailar.
Unexpectedly, a single called The Hustle from the album Disco Baby, written about the dance of the same name and recorded last for the album, went to the top of both the Billboard Pop and R&B charts and won a Grammy Award. Van McCoy died from a heart attack in Englewood, New Jersey on July 6, 1979 at the age of 39. He is buried in the McCoy family plot at Lincoln Cemetery in Suitland, Maryland, a suburb of Washington, D.C., not far from the VOA studios. We'll be right back. ever done the hustle? You ought to check it out on YouTube. You might enjoy, get a lot of exercise in, you know. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zainab Abdelrahman, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, hoping you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from Van McCoy and the Soul City Symphony.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Ethiopia has been suffering the effects of a devastating series of droughts, which began 3 years ago when the El Niño weather pattern caused higher temperatures in this country of 100 million people. While an above-average rainy season this year is expected to help improve agriculture in parts of the country, the damage done by several consecutive failed rainy seasons has been significant, resulting in widespread crop failures and devastating loss of livestock, and leading to successive humanitarian disasters. Further compounding the situation is a large-scale displacement of approximately 1 million people since April in the West Guji and Gedeo zones of the Oromia region and Southern Nations Nationalities and Peoples region, respectively. This newly displaced population is in addition to the 1.6 million Ethiopians already pushed from their homes by conflict or drought. With large-scale displacement occurring along the border of the Oromia and Somali regions, who need immediate vital humanitarian assistance. Today, as a result of these conditions, nearly 8 million are facing hunger, particularly in Oromia and southern Somali regions. In late July, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, announced an additional $170 million in humanitarian assistance to support the people of the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia. This new funding brings the total U.S. humanitarian contribution for Ethiopia to more than $802 million since October 2016. The funds will go toward emergency food and nutrition assistance, life-saving medical care, shelter, and safe drinking water, as well as programs to improve sanitation and hygiene programs to stop the spread of preventable diseases. This assistance will provide vital humanitarian aid to millions of Ethiopians trying to recover from the shock suffered since 2016, as well as to refugees who are seeking shelter in Ethiopia. This assistance will meet the immediate needs of those displaced, keeping them healthy so that they can return home safely and voluntarily, resume productive lives, and participate in the process of addressing the root causes of conflict, said USAID Mission Director to Ethiopia, Leslie Reed. The United States urges additional contributions from the government of Ethiopia and for the community of nations to meet the needs of vulnerable Ethiopians.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. This is